The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, we got it wrong. Do we admit we were wrong? Do we try to reestablish some kind of relationship with Trump? Or do we double down on the calculation that we made? And they doubled down on it. So they said to themselves, we got it wrong about the coming disaster. We thought it was going to be in the election. Our timing was wrong, but our basic analysis was 100% correct. The disaster is coming. And now we are the guardians of virtue and purity guarding the castle. And we'll be around to pick up the pieces after the destruction comes. Psychologically and emotionally, they're invested in Trump's defeat. And that's one of the reasons why they grabbed, psychological reasons why they grabbed hold of the Trump-Russia collusion.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 2nd, 2018. A few days ago, I tweeted at my old colleague, Mike Duran, that he should come to my office and record a long conversation about Trump, Russia, and how he parted ways with his many colleagues who became never-Trump conservatives. Duran is a former Brookings colleague of mine, now at the Hudson Institute. A Middle East specialist, he served in the George W. Bush White House, at the State Department, and at the Pentagon. He is unusual among Washington foreign policy and national security elites in being vocally supportive of President Trump and dismissive of the Trump-Russia investigation. We had a long and very frank conversation, which I am posting largely unedited in two parts. This, the first half, deals with how Duran broke with the never-Trumpers, how he sees the president, and how he sees the Russia investigation in broad strokes. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 273, Through the Looking Glass with Mike Duran, part one. Mike, let's start with what makes you different from a lot of your former colleagues in government, your think tank colleagues. A year or so ago, a little more, the vast majority of the people who thought of you as a peer, sort of conservative foreign policy, national security analysts, signed these letters that formed the kind of molten core of the Never Trump movement, at least in the foreign policy and national security space. You did not, and you have become... in your public life, one of the most prominent people who makes the affirmative case for Donald Trump and his foreign policy and national security policy. And so I'm interested in starting with the question of what makes you different from all of these other people. You know, it must be a weird experience to watch all these people that you've worked with go in sort of a radically different direction from your own instincts. So just talk me through that.
Yeah. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Walking into the lion's den.
Before I answer your question, let me just tell you how much I appreciate being invited to talk to you.
I appreciate your coming.
As I mentioned to you on Twitter, over the last year, I've written to you at least 10 times, maybe even 20, started emails to you in response to something I read on Lawfare that made my head explode. And I wanted to try to explore the disagreement I had with you, and then I would just look at it and say, well, what's the point? It's just going to make him angry, and so why bother? But here we can actually discuss it.
Yeah, let's do that.
So in answer to your question, I don't think there's a simple answer, but it started in April of 2016. That's when I started arguing with all the guys who became Never Trumpers, telling them that he was going to win, or that I thought he had an extremely good chance. I thought for most of the campaign, once Trump was nominated, I thought he was going to win. There were a few moments, you know, like right after the Access Hollywood tape and everything, where I had doubts, but I thought it was really his to lose. And they never did. And I think that's an extremely important point, because I thought their letters were absurd. I thought they were outrageous, actually. But one of the things that I thought about them, and I continue to think about them, I think it's an absolute, the absolutely crucial detail, is that they never actually believed he was going to win. They believed two things. They believed Hillary was going to win, and they believed that Trump was going to deliver an historic defeat to the Republican Party. And so I thought that they were reading the country wrong. And then secondly, I thought they had a misperception of what the role of Washington foreign policy experts is, where we fit. Even, and I don't put myself at the upper ranks, right? Even the best of them, right? The most experienced and the most influential, where they fit in the firmament. You don't build a political party around Washington pundits and bureaucrats. That's not the way the system works. So they were imagining themselves, I thought, and I continue to think that they think this way in some respect. They thought that those letters would actually might have some kind of impact in the election, which was nonsensical. They just confirmed Trump's major message, which is that he was fighting against the establishment. So the establishment said, we don't like you. So that just helped him. Then they thought that they would be around to rebuild the party after Trump brought about its collapse. And they're still thinking that way. The big decision they had to make after Trump won was, okay, we got it wrong. Do we admit we were wrong? Do we try to reestablish some kind of relationship with Trump, or do we double down on the calculation that we made? And they doubled down on it, and they doubled down on the note. So they said to themselves, "Oh, well, we got it wrong about the coming disaster. We thought it was going to be in the election. Our timing was wrong, but our basic analysis was 100% correct. The disaster is coming. And now we are the guardians of virtue and purity, you know, guarding the castle. And we'll be around to pick up the pieces after the destruction comes." Psychologically and emotionally, they're invested in Trump's defeat. And that's one of the reasons why they grabbed, psychological reasons why they grabbed hold of the Trump-Russia. But you and I are going to disagree on this. But the Trump-Russia collusion, which I think is a total, what was the name of the case in California? McMaster? No, McMullen, McMurphy, the daycare center where they accused the people who owned it of, you remember that thing?
Yes, I remember the case. I don't remember the
mass delusion. I think the Trump-Russia collusion is a mass delusion. And among the never-Trumpers, and there's psychological reasons why people grabbed hold of it on both sides, but among the never-Trumpers, it's that need for there to be a disaster so that they could be right and they could preserve their sense of themselves and the role that they play in politics.
Okay, so I want to return to Trump-Russia later, but I'm interested in, before we do, in your assessment of Donald Trump. In your Twitter feed, you're often responding to anti-Trump people rather than talking affirmatively about what you believe about the president and his administration. But let's zero base it. What do you make of Donald Trump?
Before I answer that question, let me just say that that's right. Because where the emotion on my Twitter feed comes from is that I'm anti-Trump. I find the anti-Trump case, like I said, ridiculous. So that is what I'm, that's where I'm sort of always taking my, holding my ground.
Okay, but what is your positive belief about him? I mean, is this a presidency with which you're comfortable? A person?
I would start with, I think Trump has not been given credit for a couple of things that should have made everyone stop, pause, and say, hey, where are we? In a different way than they did. I mean, sort of everyone did in a way, but not in the way that I think they should have. First of all, he deserves credit for one of the most amazing political victories in American history, and which was based on a real insight into the state of the country and the electorate.
And how would you characterize that insight?
He had an understanding of, I would say, of how much ordinary Americans have not benefited from globalization in the last 20 years, and how much anger there was among average Americans, average middle, lower middle class Americans, about that. You know, I was in a green room at CNN with Rick Santorum once, a few months back, year back, can't even remember when it was. But he told me this amazing story about how Trump had called him to Trump Tower after the 2012 election. And have you heard this story? And he told him that he'd read his book. Santorum had a book, you know, about the forgotten man. And Trump basically told him, you got it totally right. You understand what's going on. And Trump basically took the Santorum, this is now me talking, not Santorum, I'm not sure what Santorum was able to say, but he took the Santorum playbook and downplayed the social conservatism. So, the message was, you're hurting, the elite doesn't care about you, jobs, 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 jobs. That's the basic message. And that, I think, was an incredibly winning message. And he won in a way. He put together a coalition on a shoestring budget, relatively speaking, against the Republican establishment, against the establishment Democrat candidate. He pulled off this amazing victory in ways that everyone said he couldn't do it. So that alone should make everyone stop and say, what happened? Instead, they grabbed hold of this Trump-Russia. Russia handed him the election. That's nonsense. The guy had a political insight.
Okay, so let's give him credit for a political insight. A political insight that gives rise to an electoral victory is not a presidency, right? It's a campaign. One of the things that profoundly upsets me about Donald Trump is, and I understand if this comes off as priggish and prudish, but the uncivilized nature of his behavior, just the way he tweets insults at random individuals, this doesn't seem to bother you. And I'm trying to figure out why.
No, that's not true. That's not true. It actually, that does, that particular thing, the tweeting insults at people, that bothers me. But it doesn't rise to the level of, Bill Clinton's womanizing. Does that bother you?
It bothered me enormously, and I did not vote for him for re-election in 1996 because of Stuart Taylor's long piece in The American Lawyer about Paula Jones. And I was never able to look at Bill Clinton the same way after I read that piece. And I was part of a Washington Post editorial board that was, pretty tough on him in the context of the Lewinsky stuff. And I furthermore wrote a rather sympathetic book about Ken Starr, though it was ultimately a critique.
So I was expecting you to say something else. I was expecting you to say, yes, it bothered me, but I still voted for him. I didn't know you didn't. You didn't vote for him.
I didn't vote for him in 1990. I did vote for him in 1992, and I was never more excited to cast a ballot than I was as a 22-year-old voting for Bill Clinton. And within 4 years, I couldn't do it again.
You'll be amused to know that I voted for him. you may be amused to know that I also at the time hated Ken Starr. I go back and forth in my mind right now because I really don't like the Mueller probe, and I don't like special counsels in general. I think they're absurd, but I think they're unconstitutional, basically. But nobody's asking me for my view on the Constitution. I go back and forth in my mind. At the time when I didn't like Ken Starr, I was a Democrat, and I'm wondering if I had been a Republican then, would I have been excited about Ken Starr? But anyway, my point with you with raising the whole thing is that there's no, you don't ever get a president that has every quality that you want. And the coarseness of Trump, and it doesn't, for me, it's something that I wish you didn't do. But my feeling about it is not that it doesn't cross any line that I think that disqualifies him from the office. I just think it's counterproductive. But I'm also aware of the fact that this guy had the entire media against him. Even Fox News wasn't all that supportive of him. And he found a way to communicate with the American electorate. So I kind of take a step back and think, okay, this guy is operating according to a different playbook than we've ever seen. He's savvy, he's cunning, and he knows how to get his message out to the people. That alone deserves a certain amount of respect. But I think there's something kind of Shakespearean about him, in that he often empowers the very forces that he's fighting. You know, and this is just, I can't think of a better word than Shakespearean. I mean, he goes, attacks the New York Times, and then gives them major interviews.
Right, he has a peculiarly codependent relationship with the media that he loathes.
Right, yeah.
But okay, so you want him to get credit for the electoral victory, and you're troubled by, or the coarseness bothers you but doesn't particularly offend you. But when you look back on the year of his presidency, what is it that before you get to the anti-Trump stuff, what is the positive case that you feel that this is a presidency worthy of your support?
Oh, I think, first of all, the anti-anti is part of that. So we'll get to it in greater detail. But I do believe that there is an unconstitutional effort to nullify an election by the elite. Right. That's what I think the Mueller probe is. That's what I think the whole Trump-Russia collusion thing is. I think it's outrageous. I think it's the biggest scandal of my lifetime. And that alone makes me want him to succeed, because I think it's very bad for the system that unelected bureaucrats in collusion with the opposition political party can foist this kind of thing on a presidency. So that.
We will get to that question.
Yeah, for sure. But that's
so that's one thing.
But that's a major thing. I mean, my desire for him to succeed has increased in direct proportion to the effort to bring him down by the opposition.
The
unelected opposition.
Who was your preferred candidate? I remember early in the Republican primaries, you were supporting Scott Walker.
Scott Walker. That was my early choice.
And so, when Walker dropped out, who did you support at that point?
I moved to Rubio.
So you're in that sense a relatively conventional Republican establishment guy. Up through.
No, there's a little difference there. Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I'm a hybrid, I guess. You know, I came to Washington from academia, and I was brought to the White House to work for Elliot Abrams. Elliot Abrams, I'm sure most of your listeners know, is in the center of the neocon world. And everybody I would always be identified as a neocon. I didn't bother to argue with people about it. I would jokingly say I'm a running dog of the neocons.
I'm very Maoist of you.
I never fully I never fully identified with the neocon worldview, but it corresponded to enough of the things that I believed. And partly I didn't have, as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young says, life is for learning. So I understand my own politics better as I get older. And I never totally was part of that. That's why the natural thing for me would have been to go to Bush, because I worked in the Bush White House. So the George W. Bush White House. So the natural thing would be to go to Jeb for the election. But I went to Walker, and the same thing that makes me respond positively to Trump, I think, is what drew me to Walker. I have what my colleague at Hudson, Walter Russell Mead, calls a Jacksonian streak in my politics.
All right, so let's talk about, before we turn to Trump Russia, are there other features of the administration other than admiration for the electoral triumph itself and a kind of ferocious resistance to the anti-Trump mobilization that you look upon with particular satisfaction, or are those the two major components?
Well, I would sort of unpack the one about the electoral insight. I mean, I just mentioned to you that I have a Jacksonian streak. I vote with red America. The prophet Muhammad said that my people will not agree on an error. And so I have the same attitude toward my people. Red America is my people. And I don't believe that I have not seen the American, the Republican electorate as excited by a candidacy of anyone since Ronald Reagan. And you've got to say, well, what are they responding to? I think it's much more than Trump the man, right? There's something going on out there. Hillary saw it when she lost the Michigan primary to Bernie Sanders. There's something going on out there, and because I think that it's not just his reading of the mood, the commitment of the Washington elite, of the elite of the Republican and the Democratic Party, the blind commitment to globalization at the expense of working people in the United States is a deep insight. I think we are in need of a serious recalibration across the board, and I think that Trump is the best option, is the best hope of that kind of recalibration.
And have you, over the course of the year of his presidency, one of the things that has struck me is that was the rhetoric of his campaign, and it's certainly his rhetoric in office. And yet it's very hard for me to see anything in his governing behavior that reflects anything other than quite traditional conservative orthodoxies of precisely the type that he railed against in that context. And so how do you reconcile the insight and rhetoric and tone of the Trump campaign and presidency with the governing reality of it?
Well, I think that that is the great challenge of the Trump administration, is that how do you translate what was really instinct and some degree of political insight. He's a very hard person to read, Trump, because he doesn't let you into his interior life at all. I mean, and the Washington Post and the New York Times would tell you there is no such thing. It's like, what a joke. How could we ever say this? But you can't have the achievements that this guy has had in his career without, just on instinct and cunning, there's something going on behind the mask. Whatever that combination of characteristics is, translating it into effective policy is extremely difficult because he doesn't have the cohort. He doesn't have the cohort to do that. You can't do that. You can't the kind of recalibration that he wants to effect. And I actually believe he does want to effect it. That, I mean, most people, I suppose you would see him as a total, I'm assuming, I don't know, you know, sort of cynical con man. I think that translating that into policy across the board is a big challenge. And, you know, by the time he's finished You know, we probably won't grade him. We certainly won't grade him A+. Will he even get an A? I don't know. Will he get a B-, a C+? I don't know. But the challenge, he's the guy who defined the challenge. I think he defined it correctly. Whether he'll succeed in implementation, I don't know. But there's a lot of people who don't want him to even try, and they're using a lot of nefarious methods to stop it.
Okay, let's turn to those nefarious methods. The listeners of this podcast, I think, will overwhelmingly have a kind of through-the-looking-glass attitude toward your own on a lot of these questions. That is to say...
Something tells me you're right.
that is to say, I think most of the listeners of the podcast and a lot of people who write for Lawfare and a lot of people who read Lawfare were alarmed early by the Russia stuff, have been supportive of the investigation of it, and have been very alarmed by the president's interactions with that investigation. You have almost the opposite reaction.
Total opposite
reaction. Near.
There are some residual points where I could agree with you, but my basic reaction is total rejection of that point of view.
Right. So let's start by having you sketch out the narrative as you understand it. When you look at the last, it's really 18 months of the Russia story with respect to Trump, what is the story to you?
So it's a big story, right? It's a very big story.
Where does it start and what's the basic trajectory of it?
It starts with Trump. It starts with the Hillary Clinton email investigation. And that damaged her greatly, because it later opened to the basic claim that Hillary Clinton had A, behaved illegally in setting up her own server and in putting classified material on the on her emails, and B, she was probably hacked by the Russians, so she put U.S. national security at risk before the Russian threat, and so her campaign needed an answer to that accusation, and the campaign came up with the political answer to that accusation with the Steele dossier. Because the Steele dossier, the gist of it in one sentence is, Donald Trump is in league with the Russians. He has been compromised by the Russians, and he's Vladimir Putin's puppet. So Hillary Clinton may have made some kind of mistake with some emails she sent, but Donald Trump is the Manchurian candidate. And that was her answer to that. That's where it begins. And then she and her supporters took the Steele dossier, which they paid for, which they created, in league with the Russians, by the way, right? The amazing thing about in this moment when we're supposed to be so concerned about the Russian threat, and when we have a special prosecutor investigating it, we have this dossier which is sourced to Russian intelligence, directly sourced to Russian intelligence. So they took that and they handed that to the FBI, which began an investigation of Donald Trump on the basis of bogus Oppo research paid for by the Democrats, informed by Russian intelligence. And then they leaked that to the press in order to leak the fact of an investigation into Trump by the American bureaucracy in order to counter the accusation that she had put national security at risk. So it starts there. That's the key starting point. And the dossier is the source of everything. Without the dossier, there is no Mueller probe. So the corruption begins right there.
Okay, so I want to... What I want to do is avoid getting into an extended back and forth about individual facts, because I think we'll get bogged down in the weeds and that's probably not constructive. But I do want to challenge you on the fundamental fact of what you just said, which is, how do you purport to know any of that? I know that there was a Steele dossier and that Chris Steele did some investigation and produced some material to Fusion GPS. I know that there were some contacts and the FBI had a certain degree of interest in his work. I know that the FBI launched an investigation. And I also know that a whole bunch of people, including me, in that period of time were alarmed by things that we knew about Trump and Russia and their relationship that were fully in public. Like, for example, the president, then the candidate, talking in this very bizarre way about Vladimir Putin, even when it was seemed politically disadvantageous to do so, calling on the Russians to release hacked emails, which they, of course, then did. And this very dramatic Russian intervention in the campaign through the release of these hacked emails on Trump's behalf. And so I look at it and I say, if I were the FBI, I don't know what the relationship was between the Bureau and the Steele dossier and any of that. But if I were a counterintelligence agent at the FBI, there is no way the spring and summer of 2016 was going to happen without a serious counterintelligence investigation happening, particularly given that certain people associated with the Trump campaign at very central levels, like Paul Manafort, had rather conspicuous foreign agent registration issues. And so I guess my big question is, why the fixation on the Steele dossier and that aspect of the narrative, instead of looking at it and saying, gosh, there was this very peculiar relationship between Trump and the Russians quite early, about which he was transparent and open, actually to his credit, and that would spark the counterintelligence interest of any counterintelligence officers. And so the result was an FBI investigation.
So, a couple of points. Point number one, I think you just conceded the major point, which is that all this was out in the open. Trump's, whatever you want to call it, sympathy, infatuation, desire for a reset with Putin was out there. I didn't like it, by the way. That is,
how do you feel about it now?
Let me finish the point. Of all the things about Trump, the two things that I was most the thing I was most uncomfortable with was the desire for a reset with Russia. But I told you my people will not agree on an error. I trust the Red America not to let any Republican president go that far toward getting in bed with a character like Putin. Secondly, I work on the Middle East policy, and I listen very closely to all of Trump's statements on the Middle East. And pretty early on, even back when I was on the Walker campaign, I believe, I recognized that Trump was not running a campaign on foreign policy, on a serious discussion of policy. All of his messages on foreign policy and on the Middle East were designed to reinforce his central message about the forgotten man and the elite is not listening to you. And part of that was the elite wants to go off and, you know, slay monsters abroad. And we don't have to do that. And I'm a tough guy and a savvy negotiator, and I can make this relationship with Russia work, even though this guy's difficult. So first of all, I didn't hear what you heard when Trump said nice things about Putin. I heard a New York City real estate magnate, you know, who's used to living in a world where there are lots of tough competitors in New York real estate, other families that are his enemies. And yet, you know, today they're my enemy. We're bidding for the same piece of property. But tomorrow I might be in a joint venture with them. So I have to be savvy. I have to be tough. But I also have to maintain a line of communication. That's what I thought he was doing with Putin. But it was all out there, right? It was all out there in the open. And Hillary Clinton was making the case that he was Putin's puppet. And the founders think that these big questions should be fought out before the electorate. It was fought out before the electorate. If you think that the FBI should launch a counterintelligence investigation on the basis of this kind of information, we have a difference of opinion. But it's more than that, because everything that we know at this point is that the Steele dossier was the basis for the investigation.
And when you say that, what do you purport to for the basis of that statement to be? Because that is not like I would not sign on to that statement.
Can I take this in a slightly different direction? Sure. First, we can get back to this. I think that there has been among the analysts of the whole Trump Russia thing. I'm talking about the conservative analysts, people like Andrew McCarthy, that I respect and listen to. I think that they have not put the emphasis where it should be on all of this. I mean, or they have. There's an aspect of this thing that I think is very important that hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. Let's put it that way. And that is the informational component. The Obama administration ran an information operation against Trump. And they used the national security bureaucracy and the law enforcement bureaucracy in order to run that information operation. That's the way we have to see it.
Why?
Why? Because how do you know? How do you even know that there was a counterintelligence investigation against Trump?
You
agree that there was one.
When did we
become aware of it?
Well, we became aware of it formally in Jim Comey's testimony in March, where he announced that an investigation...
When did we first hear about it?
We first heard about it at a time when there were briefings about it on the Hill, and there were subsequent disclosures, I assume.
About it much earlier than that. We heard about it in October the election.
That's when the Hill was briefed. Harry Reid actually said publicly that he was upset that this information that had been given to him was not public.
Wait a second. Harry Reid, Democratic operative Harry Reid, said publicly before the election that you, Jim Comey, have a dossier. He didn't use the word dossier, but he was referring to the dossier. You have this, and you're not coming clean with it. That's a political message. How did Harry Reid learn that Jim Comey had the dossier?
So number one, the investigation long predates that, right? The investigation, at least according to Comey's testimony, was open in July.
So how does Harry Reid know about it? And how does Harry Reid's out talking about it? You and I both know that there's nothing more secret than a counterintelligence investigation. And yet there have been leaks during the campaign. There were leaks from July on, certainly by October. We've got David Corn and Mother Jones and Isikoff and Yahoo writing about this.
Right,
but we've got Harry Reid coming out and talking about it.
Right, but keep in mind,
and Hillary Clinton tweeting about it.
But keep in mind, and look, I'm not going to say that there have never been leaks. That's and by the way, I don't support leaks of classified materials. That's not something you're going to get me to
Doesn't
defend.
Doesn't it disturb you that during an election, leaks came out that benefited one candidate against another?
Actually, leaks came out that benefited both candidates, right? Because this is the same period of time that the New York field office was leaking all kinds of stuff that was quite disparaging of Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I consider that sort of leaking to be law enforcement leaks of sensitive information to be grotesque and inappropriate.
So here's
in the context
so
of
the, wait,
but hang on
wait,
in the context wait, of wait, the wait, Steele wait. Matter, there's another source of this information, and it is Chris Steele, who is perfectly entitled to give his material to people whom he wants to, including senators of both parties.
Look. Couple of things. Here's let me ask you what you think is going on, and I'll give you my picture, and then you tell me what I think. You probably had some tough-nosed FBI agents in the New York field office, who may well have been Republicans, by the way, right? Possibly Republicans who didn't like the way the Hillary email investigation was being handled. And leaked against it in that way. And then you had the people who were running. We now know from these texts between Lisa Page and is it Peter Stroke? And Peter Stroke that they have strong pro-Hillary sympathies, right? Or anti-Trump sympathies. So they could well have leaked in the opposite direction, right? That's already a very problematic picture.
Okay, so number one, I draw a very firm distinction between could well have leaked and leaked.
Somebody leaked.
I think that there were significant disclosures. I have no reason to think that they were not congressional disclosures, and a lot of reason to believe they were congressional disclosures, as well as leaks of opposition research by people who are entitled to do and leak opposition research. None of that necessarily implicates the FBI.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Mike Duran for coming back to Brookings to have this conversation. If you haven't already tweeted about the Lawfare Podcast or shared it on Facebook, please do so. And if you haven't left us yet a rating on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution service you use, please get on that. Our music is, of course, performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.